This episode is sponsored by Canaccord Genuity Wealth Management, experienced wealth managers who go above and beyond to guide and support you. Can-do is more than just an attitude. It's navigating today for a brighter tomorrow. Visit candowealth.com.
Hello and welcome to a special Saturday edition of Coffee House Shots. I'm Natasha Froese and I'm joined by Professor Jonathan Githens, Major from Exeter University, who specialises in counterterrorism and extremism, and David Shipley, a film producer who writes a lot about prisons and has spent time in prison himself. So there's been a lot of discussion recently, the past couple of weeks, about extremism. The Tory party is currently divided over what is the definition of extremism. Michael Gove is keen to take a tougher stance on the definition. Jonathan, as someone who's specialised in this, I wonder if you could just talk us through what the current definition of extremism looks like and what could be changed in the coming days, weeks.
When we talk about extremism and the policy definitions of extremism, we really have to go back to, at the very least, the 7/7 attacks or before that, because the government has struggled for what is almost 20 years to define what this means. It's also struggled to figure out how to take a definition and make a policy around it. And one of the main problems with the definition is that how long is a piece of string? And part of that is the power of who gets to make that definition and implement that definition. And one of the main problems is that for practitioners, the police, the security services, for civil servants, they can have a fairly clear idea of what is extremist in a specific context. When it becomes politicized, it then becomes about whose political vision of Britain or what British society should look like should be the basis for that definition.
And when we talk about extremism at the moment, obviously the Israel-Gaza war has made a lot of people talk about Islamism, but is it mostly Islamism that we're talking about? Are there other forms of extremism that the police security services are very concerned about?
So this remains, I think, one of the kind of political hot topics. We've seen over the recent months discussions about but more recently it's come to the fore about right-wing extremism, left-wing extremism. I remember when getting into the field, there were discussions about animal rights activism. We've seen it in terms of discussions around Extinction Rebellion. Again, I think, you know, there are multiple forms of extremism. I do wonder the extent to which there is a political imperative to use the word extremism when maybe what is meant is polarization and the lack of space for discussion and exchange.
David, what do you think about that?
I think that's really interesting. I do wonder if part of the reason we have this sort of ballooning extremisms is that because I think our governing class are not particularly focused on the real issues they need to be addressing. You know, Parliament spent this year legislating to stop people feeding their neighbours cats. The PM's big policies are around A-level reform and smoking law. And I think those may well be very important policies. But, you know, in an environment where the cost of living is soaring, energy bills are going up, we're in a very insecure world where the housing crisis continues. And now today we see that councils are going to be reducing the amount of water they want each person to use down to 110 litres a day in, you know, one of the wettest countries in the world, simply because we haven't built water infrastructure or reservoirs. I think it's not surprising in a country that's functioning like that, that more and more people will be very dissatisfied with the way it's run and have less faith in the middle ground and be more attracted to polarised policies.
You spent some time in prison, and one of our writers, Ian Aikson, has written about radicalization in prisons, specifically on the issue of Islamic extremism. Is that something you saw as a hotbed for a radicalization?
I think, yes. Prison is such a testing, hard, unpleasant environment in lots of ways. I think everyone who survives it tends to find, you know, meaning and a tribe to attach themselves to so they can survive. So it's not necessarily the case that, you know, people are becoming really, you know, enthused by the minutiae of jihadi readings of the Quran. It's often just that actually there's a group you can join, you can be looked after, you'll be safe. You know, even, you know, people will share food, you know, they'll make your life better. Certainly when I was in Wandsworth, there were regular issues where people were allowed Xboxes and they're not supposed to be in prison, but, you know, USB drives would be passed around and they often had lots of pornography and lots of jihadi materials. And this is very commonplace, even in a prison like Wandsworth, which isn't particularly seen as a hotbed of Islamists compared to, say, a Belmarsh, which is where you know, a lot of those guys are actually imprisoned.
Just to echo that, Natasha, when I was doing some of my own academic research, what was really interesting is not only is David right about this idea of finding tribes and finding groups and finding protection, and also finding meaning, trying to understand, you know, there were many people that talked about trying to understand, how did I end up here? Why did I end up in this life? But then there were a lot of mundane reasons as well, which was, for example, halal food was considered to be better. It was more identifiable meat, one person saying to me. Different privileges in terms of association time, in terms of getting to do things. So I think there's a number of reasons. I think to look at prisons as somehow the breeding ground of what I would call Islamically inspired political violence is not, it's a breeding ground. It can be a breeding ground, but it's not necessarily the breeding ground. I think more so what we're seeing is that kind of, there's a degree of generational change, which is driving this polarization, which is driving people to the fringes. I mean, as an older person now, I guess I would say in some ways it's not least a reflection of social media, where people know problems right away and they want instant solutions and they get frustrated that there's not an instantaneous answer for whatever issue they're passionate about because they saw it this morning on TikTok.
Yes, David, on that, the Imam Majoub Majoubi in France, who called the French flag satanic, has recently been sent back to Tunisia, and a lot of his preaching was done on TikTok. Do you think that France has done the right thing here? Should Britain be following suit in their approach to clamping down on extremism?
Yes, absolutely. I think that was the right choice. Part of the, I think the problem is that we've deluded ourselves quite a long time that we live in a post-religious world where religion doesn't really matter. It doesn't affect the public sphere. And for all of human history, religious belief has driven political action. And it was perhaps only in this tiny window of a few decades in the West that it stopped mattering. But actually, for most of the world, it does matter. And I think we, as a result of those beliefs, we've become quite lackadaisical about the idea that we can just let any people come in with any ideas. And it doesn't matter what they say, because we are a free country. In reality, though, when people are advocating for the destruction of everything that makes, you know, living in Britain good, you know, freedom, personal liberty, rights for women, you know, rights for lots of other minorities as well, I don't think a sensible liberal society can or should tolerate guests who advocate for those sorts of things. So I think this government policy talks about making it harder for hate preachers to come in, although they say it will only be the ones they've already identified, which seems like it would be quite limited. I think there's also got to be a case for talking about what we do regarding people who are here on visas, who behave in ways which are inimical to the values of this country.
Jonathan, the Home Office have announced a new plan to stop hate preachers from entering Britain by denying their visas. I suppose when I read that article, I just thought, what were they doing already? Was this not already a policy?
It was really interesting because I was, not least in preparation for coming on, I was kind of going back and trying to really understand more about some of the more recent statements. And immediately when I did my internet search, it brought up a load of articles from 2005, from 2008, from 2009. I think this has been very much an ongoing issue. You know, I think also it's a little bit, dare I say, naive, insofar as it's not a policy that anyone, I think, in their right mind should be disagreeing with. But at the same time, the people that want to find this information or expose this information don't need a preacher to be physically present to hear it. And therefore, I think it's more about, in some ways, a battle of ideas and trying to inculcate in people the idea that they should be resilient to the narratives of extremism, rather than trying to identify a single physical source for that narrative to emerge.
I'm not sure it's enough just to sort of teach people to be resilient. I think what we need are counter narratives and, you know, different messages and belief systems which provide meaning to lives. And I think probably part of the issue is we don't really have a robust set of beliefs and principles which people can gather around about being British. You know, we occasionally get these sort of very wet descriptions of very broad values, but I think there's not a kind of healthy civic nationalism for people to gather around. So, and without that, it's very hard to persuade people they shouldn't go for this belief over here where someone really believes in things.
And David's right, because the issue here is when I, you know, the freedom of speech, the freedom of engagement, the freedom of identity requires, is a responsibility that is associated with high degrees of tolerance, but also openness and respect. And when you look at someone like the rhetoric of certain politicians coming to the fore more recently, one wonders the extent to which there is a respect for opponents' ideas or a willingness to engage in it. Because ultimately, right, democracy relies on a degree of compromise, not a degree of always being right. And somehow that is a transformation, both in the British political culture, dare we say the Americanization of it, but also a hugely problematic one, which is then kind of going back to that original term, driving those degrees of polarization.
Yes, and Miriam Cates said just this week that she worries that with this new definition of extremism, there's going to be a clampdown on, for example, gender-critical feminists who are deemed by some as extremists or people who have a different view on abortion policy. David, do you, when this extremist definition comes, obviously you have to take a look at what Gove means, but do you suspect you might side on the sort of Miriam Cates side of things, or do you think you might be inclined to side with David Gove on this definition?
This is always the risk, isn't it? If you give the state the power to decide that certain ideas are anathema and can be punished by the force of the law, you then have to worry about who's going to be in charge of those decisions. And I think there does seem to be an unwillingness in some quarters to be realistic about the scales of different threats. I think if you look at the sort of number of lives lost to Islamist terrorism in this country in the last 20 years versus the number of lives lost to far-right terrorism, it's very clear that although they are both murderous threats, I think the much bigger threat is Islamist terrorism, in the same way that a lot of these laws were originally brought in around constraining animal rights activists and this sort of thing. The gender-critical feminists and the animal rights activists and Extinction Rebellion are not threatening death or attacking people and killing people. And I think we have to hopefully find some way of creating a law or policy which recognises those distinctions rather than just labelling any idea which is outside of what we've ruled acceptable and saying that's extremism, it must be punished. We can't have a situation where anti-Semitic hate chants are normalised every Saturday in London. I think that is really awful, and I think it's dangerous because it starts to make people think this is fine, this is normal, and that has a risky effect. So I do think we need to find ways of grappling with that and addressing it. And I hope the government and Michael Gove to draft something which is sensible and thoughtful and doesn't just get used, too broadly.
It's also important to recognize that ultimately the state is the vehicle for the expression of a popular political will. We live in a democracy. And one of the dangers is that, and a potential pitfall, is that policymakers, the politicians, use it as a political football to define what they consider to be within the bounds of what they want. And that's not only problematic in terms of coming up with an idea, for example, like extremism, but I also think it's problematic because, you know, we live in this era of mistrust of the state, and we live in this era of a mistrust of politicians, and it will feel like another rule coming down from above, guiding our lives, rather than empowering people in some ways to take responsibility for the exercise of that political power. And so, you know, in this process, it can't just be statements that look good on TV or, you know, an Instagram clip. It needs in some ways to have that degree of popular ownership. Now, the danger in that is squeakiest wheel gets the oil. And those communities that scream the loudest about how unfair things are somehow then get responses that perhaps are out of kilter with whole other elements of the population, thereby alienating them even further.
Obviously, we can debate over defining extremism, but when it comes to proper policy, are there any key policy areas, maybe to you, Jonathan, but also David, feel free to chip in, that are easy fixes? I mean, Raqib Hasan wrote an interesting piece in The Telegraph the other day saying we need to go back to basics, for example, doing an audit of people linked to hate groups in just simply the public sector. Are there quite pragmatic approaches we can take to combat extremism?
One of the most important things that I've seen doing, you know, two decades of working in this field is disaggregating the question of extremism from counterterrorism. Because counterterrorism is a specific skill set which is different than counter-extremism or preventing extremism. I'm not always sure that policymakers understand the distinction between those two categories. When I go back and I think about prevent, which is actually a brilliant policy in terms of working through and with communities in order to prevent extremists from taking hold, which communities themselves didn't want. But the moment it became a kind of more social or cultural project, you've got people saying this is a behavioral control exercise. So disaggregating those policies is a great step to get there. I think the other thing too is to realize we live in a context of external interference. And I think one of the bigger concerns here about hate preachers is while we're looking at it through this lens of, quite rightly so, through the lens of anti-Semitism and post-7th of October, I think we need to ask ourselves to what extent are some malign actors in the international community seeking to exploit these divisions to undermine the basic confidence of being British at the moment?
Perhaps another point is that often we don't actually implement existing policy and law as much as we could. I think it's very easy to announce a new policy and announce a new framework, but we seem quite bad at the business of actually, you know, implementing that on the ground. And I think, again, if we look at the marches sort of relating to the Gaza conflict in the last few months, what I and many other people have seen is people on these marches clearly voicing, you know, anti-Semitic chants, calling for jihad, calling for the destruction of Israel, and a lack of response, visible response from the police. Now, in many cases, they may well have, you know, because there's such big crowds, have filmed, tried to identify them and arrested afterwards. But I think the lack of a visible policing response to that sort of behaviour is really dangerous, because it starts to significantly undermine the authority of the police and of the state more generally. And I think visible, clear responses to breaches of existing law would go a long way to resetting some boundaries and norms.
The Prime Minister, I think, was right in some ways to talk about this strange alliance of far left and, dare I say, extremist Islamist groups. But I'm not sure he was right for the right reason, insofar as when we see these mass protests, it creates an environment where those that are inclined to hate the state from the beginning see this as a vehicle for expressing that discontent. And so by not tackling some of these issues head on, it does create a kind of primordial ooze from which those that actually want to destroy the state and tear at the very fabric of our society think that they've found a new vehicle. Whatever the intention of the mass, you know, the vast amount of protesters, it is now creating those conditions whereby individuals think that they can create a Britain which doesn't look like anything that we would recognize.
Thank you, Jonathan. Thank you, David. And thank you for listening.